Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Let's get into the first news story of today. And yesterday we discussed the Constitutional Court striking down a part of the National Health Insurance, which essentially saw that the government would be able to issue a certificate of need. That is essentially would control not only where doctors were allowed to practice, but also even what equipment was allowed to be deployed at certain healthcare facilities. This essentially would allow the state kind of total control over the healthcare system and where it placed its resources. The Constitutional Court found that this was not in keeping with the Constitution's right for everyone to choose their own trade and profession, and upheld a Pretoria High Court ruling about it earlier. The Department of Health, however, rather than sort of meditating on what this means for the system, what this means for South Africa's healthcare system, whether they had gone wrong in some places, simply said, no big deal. We're going to continue to go ahead with NHI as aggressively as we have before. The department said the sections in question were passed by Parliament 23 years ago and have never been brought into effect. Thus, there is no direct impact of the judgment on the NHI. No section of the NHI has been declared unconstitutional. We will soldier ahead nonetheless. This kind of comports with comments made by the Health Minister, Aaron Motsoaledi, recently about judgments regarding the NHI. Speaking to a Nurses Day event in East London over a week ago, he said that he was concerned about judges' stances on the NHI during court challenges, and that he hoped they would be sober in their judgment. I'm asking the judges who have got that benefit being private medical aid, a benefit that is unfair, please make a judgment over it. That's the trouble that I'm having. Judges become so... he wished that the judges would become sober about universal health coverage. I was looking at those judges in their eyes. They are beneficiaries of the same system that I am talking about, but they must provide over a judgment, basically implying that they would not be impartial. He also said that, once again, one of the main talking points in defense of the NHI, that 51% of total healthcare expenditure of the country was only for 14% of the population. The remaining 49% of expenditure is shared by 86% of the population, where there are long queues and a shortage of staff. Terence, the health minister seems to kind of almost even be at odds with parts of the ANC on how dogmatically he is pursuing the NHI, to the point that he's sort of almost in open conflict with Treasury. On this, Treasury sort of refuses to fund him, and his rhetoric only seems to be getting more extreme and more intense. What's your take on this?
Well, he's an ideologue. For him, this is something that I think he sincerely believes in, but I think it's not a kind of pragmatic reading of the situation. Although maybe in his mind, there is an element of that, but fundamentally, this is about what he sees as a core matter of humanitarian value. I think it was Milton Friedman who said you have to judge policies by their effects, not their intentions. And I would say that the health minister is very much I'll judge me by intentions kind of guy. I have heard just in his defense that apparently he does for his own needs, he apparently does go to state institutions, which, is great. Although I do think that, there are some very good state institutions, and I suspect if you happen to be the Minister of Health, you are going to get a level of care that's a cut above what, many others would get at other state institutions. It's just,
right, they're not going to forget to feed you, and they're not going to ration you off of the dialysis machine or whatever you need.
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing, that state-established and state-owned or state-run health facilities across the world, you know, often cater for the middle class. I think it was Boris Johnson actually was admitted to, or David Cameron was admitted to a state hospital in Britain, and that was fine. France apparently their state run health system is one of the best in the world. The problem is that you are sort of confusing this, as I say, this intention and this effect, and also this cause and effect. Why do people distrust the public health health sector? Because it's been badly run. One of the big reasons for that has been because it's used as an extractive cash cow, which we saw during COVID. Now the idea is, well, why don't we just, like, you know, put everyone's money in there, and somehow things will get better. I do think that there's also a horrible sleight of hand going on. Well, you know, what does he say? 80% of the population, or 80% of spending goes to
49% goes to 86% of the population.
Okay. Right. Yes. That other pot of expenditure that's going on in the private sector is not some sort of government money that's going sort of being funneled out the back door to well-heeled people in the suburbs. Those are funds that people are spending voluntarily. Now, his plan effectively is, well, we'll take that and we'll tax you some more, and because, you know, we'll have wondrous equity, you know, those who did have these privileges, benefits, whatever phrase he wants to apply, will kind of get less, but that'll be fair. The train smash that you are heading into, you know, I've spoken to people, you know, who have a lot to lose in the event of EWC, who said they're willing to, like, tough it out in South Africa, but take away my medical aid and I'm gone. I've had leftist academics say this to me, because, you know, not everyone who might be ideologically sympathetic to this, you know, is naive about the implications. Is, you know, that just means that some services will no longer be available. Some will theoretically be available, but, you know, those queues will just exist for everyone, except perhaps if you are in the upper echelons. Notice how many African heads of state tend to die in places like Spain and Belgium and, you know, South Africa. Julius Nyerere, the great advocate of village pharmacies, didn't die on a grass mat. Well, Julius Nyerere, who was the great advocate of village pharmacies and collective economics and critic of imperialist greed, didn't die on a grass mat in a village pharmacy in northern Tanzania. He died in a private clinic in London, which just says everything you need to know. Nelson Mandela, you know, was often checked up in private facilities. The kind of smoking gun of this was Pinyaza Lesufi before the last election, telling a group of pensioners, vote for us, and then the day after the election, you can go to a private hospital. Not that we'll make the public ones better, but, you know, you're going to get the good stuff. So I'd have to say that somewhere in the back of our beloved provincial premier's mind is the idea that what the state is offering is no good. He probably acknowledges that.
I think this is, for me, the really frustrating part about this is that Nicholas Crisp and Aaron Motsoaledi, who are, I would say, publicly the two biggest advocates of NHI, have kind of refused in so many ways, I think, to properly engage with a lot of these criticisms. They've cast basically every attack on the NHI as simply being a function of vested interests. And you can see it here again in Motsoaledi's insinuation that the courts will rule against NHI because it would threaten what the judges benefit from in terms of the healthcare system. You know, obviously people who have private healthcare don't want to lose it. So yes, they are defending their, I guess, vested interests. But for example, as you say, you know, if people are getting worse quality healthcare or forced to go to public healthcare systems, they're not going to pay into the system as much as they do when they can get good quality private healthcare. So that 51% will decrease because, you know, people aren't going to be paying as much towards healthcare if the quality is worse. And this is why I think NHI continues to be one of the greatest threats to the country's future stability, because it would effectively end the middle class. I think, you know, one of the first things people do in South Africa the moment they can afford it is they get on medical aid, because everyone has heard the stories and knows what happens to you in a public hospital. And yet, it's sort of so continuously being pushed by ahead by Motsoaledi and Crisp. That being said, I do think that NHI really is running now into a dead end. As we know, its implementation has been suspended by the president pending the various court challenges against it. We've had the certificate of need thing now defeated in court. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm optimistic that there will be more court defeats ahead for NHI. And we have the fact that Treasury within government continues to drag its feet on funding NHI, perhaps recognizing how much of a disaster it would be. Am I being too optimistic by thinking that NHI is never going to be implemented?
I would be reluctant to say never, but I do think that there seems to be interests within the state that are slow walking it. I think that the ANC as a party got a big wake up call when they thought this was going to be the big calling card at the election. It seems to have done them a huge amount of damage. Reversed what, you know, what polling was saying was a gradual increase in the final days before the election, and just to put that into a tailspin. I think though that even if it is never actually implemented, the mere shadow of this over our politics creates its own set of problems. Doctors or aspirant doctors who might just, you know, want to head for the departure hall as soon as they graduate or as soon as they can. People who might, you know, you might think, well, engineering rather than medicine, because I don't want to be shipped out to Matubatuba, you know, after I graduate. And I think it also takes the focus off so much of what is really wrong with health service provision. You know, for South Africa's indigent, there is effectively free healthcare. It's not always of the greatest quality, and I think we have a kind of attitudinal problem that South Africans want to go to hospitals, you know, the big name institutions. They don't want to go to the neighborhood clinic. Now, this primary healthcare focus, I think, is actually a sound idea for a country like South Africa. But, you know, those clinics then have to be properly capacitated, and people have to want to use them. That's been an issue that we haven't been able to overcome. My understanding is that what NHI would do is will basically say, you know, you have no choice but to go to that clinic. And then, you know, if we decide, you can sort of, you know, move up the food chain. I suspect that would get a great deal of blowback, including from poor people who, you know, spend a lot of their very meager income on cash for private healthcare. The real solution is to actually sort out your state institutions first. Try to maybe entice the middle class to come, you know, to use Joburg Gen and not the, you know, Parktown Mediclinic or whatever. I'm just throwing that out as a placeholder name. As I say, look, I have some experience with a state institution, and I was quite impressed. Look, it's sort of outpatient treatment. I think that to be kind of put into a ward or whatever, you know, takes it into a different level. But I didn't get the sense that it was that this particular facility was a bad one. But I imagine that there are many people like you or like me who would maybe be willing to use that facility if perhaps we could get like a sort of private room or something. This was something I remember being suggested back in the 1990s by a health economist who actually had some links to the health department under Dr. Dlamini Zuma, saying that he thinks they're doing a great job, but he says this obsession with equality and providing the same for everyone is not sustainable in an unequal society, because people who are able to buy their way out of some of these problems, you know, will want to do it. So he said, there's nothing wrong with going to Joburg, Jen, but maybe you just want a nicer room and maybe you can pay for that. And maybe then that brings the custom back in there. If it's ideological, though, then that discussion won't even get started.
Yeah. I think it's worth sort of underlining again and again that the biggest problem with our health system is not necessarily a lack of funding. It is, above all else, a management problem, a poor management problem. And until that poor management problem is fixed, you're not going to convince the middle class. You're not going to get anyone to trust the state with spending over the entire healthcare system. You're not going to improve healthcare incomes, outcomes for the poor, no matter how much money you pump into the system, until those basics are sorted in terms of how the money is actually spent.
Look, story I love to tell from the 1990s was reading in a kind of left-wing NGO journal talking about, you know, why South Africa needs nationalization rather than privatization. Because if you compare this to something, to like the state-owned entity equivalent in Sweden, then I thought, that's great. Can we get the Swedes to please give us their civil service and we can proceed on that basis? Sweden, by the way, is not quite the socialist paradise people think it is. It's not socialist at all. And I know Nordic leaders get very, very upset when they have to go and explain to university audiences in America, no, we are not a socialist country. We are not socialist countries. We are market economies which have welfare nets. Make of that what you want. No.
Very, very different. Accent. Yeah, very, very different. Very different model. All right, let's move on to our next story. And once again, these so-called study groups are back in focus. These are meetings between ANC MPs, which there's nothing wrong with, but often attending these meetings are government department officials, sometimes very senior ones, who will allegedly brief ANC MPs and even ministers and things, or the people supposed to be doing the oversight, chairpersons and such, of what the ministry is up to, and allow them to essentially pre-game and pre-plan before committee meetings happen, allowing them either to set up ways of blocking or defending, or alternatively of directing away from accountability. Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure from the DA, Minister Dean McPherson, has attacked these recently in a answer to a parliamentary question. He says, despite the fact that the Zondo Commission took a dim view of these ANC study groups back from when the ANC still had a majority, even, according to McPherson, these study groups are a tool of escaping accountability. The Zondo Commission found the following: ministers frequently attended ANC study groups which preceded portfolio committee meetings. There's evidence that a minister colluded in such a meeting to frustrate proper oversight by a portfolio committee. Care should be taken to avoid creating an impression that a portfolio committee's oversight responsibilities have been fettered by decisions taken at a study group. In response to a question on these from the DA MP Bonginkosi Madikizela, McPherson said, I've been made aware through tip-offs that officials from the administration are attending study groups of political parties and are briefing them on department matters outside of portfolio committee meetings. This is information that is used to advance political agendas and what is becoming more apparent to fight back against our efforts to enforce accountability. I must add that many of them feel deeply uncomfortable about doing so, but are, quote, compelled to do so. I'm also aware from similar tip-offs that senior officials brief certain MPs to plant false or misleading information in an attempt to fight back against the cleanup in the department. This has been confirmed to me by MPs themselves. McPherson issued a directive in 2024 that no official should attend any political study group and that respective officials do not indulge in briefings or soliciting support from political parties for their agenda. McPherson said, there is no doubt that some officials are seeking to use study groups as a means to advance their vested interests or to distract from their activities as we make progress in undoing the rot and criminality that exists in our department. Interesting here, Terence, that he seems to imply that some of these officials are not even that keen necessarily on to provide this information, but feel some sort of threat against themselves. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I picked up on that as well. Look, I think that there's a number of things going on here. One very, very sinister reality of South Africa is that I think what started off as political deployment has morphed into a kind of organized crime system. This has certainly been suggested to me at local government level. That people who were, let's say, deployed by the ANC may still consider themselves party deployees. But frankly, this has got nothing to do with ideology or party support anymore. This has got to do with the fact that they are now the kind of pipeline into the various mafias and whatever. And the ANC T-shirt is a useful accoutrement to wear while you're doing it. I suspect that what that might be referring to is that the relevant officials might have been put into their positions with some sort of political patronage in the past and still feel, say, a residual loyalty. And then also there's the ecosystem that you function in, there's the people you socialize with. Unfortunately, what South Africa has failed to do, and you know, I can pretty much quote the government on this now. It hasn't professionalized, and I would say really institutionalized its government. There's a sense that that accountability, you know, flows to your political patron or to, you know, your minister, or not that it goes up through a strict hierarchy established by your workplace. I've also had this discussion more times than I can recall with people, some within the ANC, some people who would have been sympathetic to it in the 1990s because you couldn't trust apartheid bureaucrats and whatever. Okay, fine. The problem is that once you have gone down this route, you have created a system where people have a vested interest in maintaining a particular political arrangement. There are certainly some who would perhaps fear, you know, their vulnerability to prosecution if you did clean things up. There are those who probably just loathe the DA. You know, it's just that simple. And we, you know, we intend to do everything we can to push them out. The problem is, though, there's a direct line. Well, one of the many problems is there is a direct line between that, our failing hospitals, our failing municipalities, because it's not the work that needs to be done. It's the patronage that has to be dispensed. I was reading a document from 2009, a bit earlier today, about the state of local government. And I remember this was in the early Zuma era. So let's not romanticize this, but they say that a culture of corruption and patronage is now so deeply entrenched in local government that the formal channels of accountability no longer mean anything. And that was 17 years ago. I don't imagine anything's changed. And you know, unfortunately now this is the kind of hand we've been dealt. Maybe the changes in the Public Service Act will start to shift the needle there. But it was also actually suggested to me that one of the things that has happened is the ANC now is actually staring into the abyss for itself, and it's decided on this, you know, stepping back, professionalizing, in order to effectively protect its own people in power, because it doesn't want a situation where a new crop of ministers comes in and then says, oh, you know, we're going to bring our own people in because we can't trust the people who were there before. Unfortunately, I think the ANC has created a situation where that is, it's going to be a problem for the next, you know, decade, two decades, perhaps.
Yeah, you know, this is one of the problems, is once you undermine meritocracy, not that I think we've ever had a proper meritocracy really in the South African state, but once you've kind of thrown the principle out the door, it becomes very difficult to sort of reassemble it. And I think that's the kind of position that we're in, is that we, you know, there's a lot of people in who are keen to prevent anyone from outshining them, or who are honest from coming in to shine the spotlight on nefarious things they might be up to, or people who don't put party loyalty first. So unwinding this will take quite a long time. But I think the first thing is really just for the politicians and the public to hold officials to account, and for managers of officials who don't perform or who are corrupt or whatever to also be held to account, to just have strict standards for these things. As our former colleague Saragon would always point out, is that even with our difficult labor laws, if you just simply start processes, disciplinary processes, follow things properly, you know, have proper management systems, you can actually go a long way, even within our current frameworks, to introduce discipline, to make sure that people sure. account and that people do their job. And until that becomes a rigorous part of our government culture, it's going to be really difficult to actually, I think, get things moving.
No, absolutely. You know, I think I recently had an exchange with somebody who said to me that, well, cadre deployment and meritocracy are not mutually exclusive, because someone like Brian Molefe or Siyabonga Gama would have aced any exam to get into any civil service. You know, very accomplished people on paper. I remember Brian Molefe was hailed as a, you know, back you know, when he was still a toddler, was hailed as this prodigy. And my response to that is, no, you know, this is not going to solve every problem, but we can solve this problem. You know, and we will have enough problems, you know, after this goes, that you know, we don't need to willfully add another one. So yes, there will be shysters, there will be hucksters, there will be dishonest fellows who can, you know, sneak in and, you know, have the doctorate and, you know, the social graces and whatever. South Africa's been taken for a ride many times by people, you know, who've, you know, made out to be more than they were. For those who don't remember, the 1990s, there was a commentator called Eugene Nyati who was just like on every show, very articulate. Now, it turns out he didn't have any of the qualifications, whatever. He just like found a niche for himself. I remember I used to think he was just absolutely brilliant. But yeah, so we'll have plenty of that. Let's not add the political interference.
Yeah, exactly. All right, for our last story, this is a piece on the dailyfriend.co.za from our colleague Ricardo Teixeira, talking about the South African National Defence Force and how, in his words, it's essentially become the ANC's employment force. So I'll quote a bit from his piece here. 30 years ago, the South African National Defence Force existed for one primary reason: to defend the Republic, its people, and territorial integrity against external threats, and if necessary, fight and win wars on behalf of the state. This was its constitutional purpose, its strategic justification. Everything else was secondary. Today, under the African National Congress government, the SANDF is increasingly being referred to not as a war-fighting institution, but as a socio-economic intervention mechanism. President Ramaphosa's recent remarks at the Department of Defense said that the SANDF is, quote, a partner in government efforts to curb unemployment. This amounts to far more than a harmless political soundbite. They represent a quiet but unmistakable admission that the South African military has drifted so far from combat readiness, the state is now searching for an alternative justification for its existence. SANDEF is not an employment agency. It is not a youth empowerment program. It is not a state-funded skills incubator. Armies exist to project organized violence in defense of national interests. When political leadership begins defining military relevance primarily through job creation and skills development, it is usually because the institution can no longer credibly fulfill its actual purpose. If SANDEF can be portrayed as a tool for combating unemployment, skills shortages, and social instability, then its bloated personnel structure becomes politically defensible. Under this logic, soldiers no longer need to justify their existence through military readiness. Their existence is justified through developmental utility. And Terence, this intersects, I think, so well with often what we hear from government, particularly from President Ramaphosa, that it's almost as though the only way to fight unemployment is for the state to sort of just create jobs. Those jobs may not necessarily do anything, but, you know, we're just going to create
it's a gesture. It's a gesture.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, what do I think of this? I disagree with Ricardo to the extent that I think it's actually worse than what he paints out. not only are you pouring money into an institution that can't do its job, this is an institution with guns. I think there is a real danger for a little bit of freelancing here.
It's not just an institution with guns. It's an institution that's increasingly, as Ricardo talks about a bit in his piece, is being used to supplement the police.
Sure, yeah. And, we've seen the sort of, freewheeling do-it-yourself foreign policy. You know, you're going to go and fight for Iran. I don't think we could drive a speedboat through the Strait of Hormuz these days. Probably the Iranians would shoot it. It's dangerously farcical. I remember this is probably about 1994. It was Constant Fillon, who was the head of the old SADF at one stage, and subsequently Freedom Front Plus. Although I disagree with a lot of his politics, I think the country owes a large debt because I think he pulled a very disruptive part of the population back from the abyss. He said, the idea that the army is going to be a tool of nation building, that is a political goal, not a military goal. I've maintained on this platform that if you are going to see the army in these sort of terms, let me put it another way, if you are not going to capacitate your army to fight an external foe, have them properly equipped, you know, with the weapons, with the ammunition, with a magazine depth, by the way, a phrase I learned from Ricardo, it means like how long you can fight with what you have in your inventories. You learned that on the Daily Friend. The vehicles, the airlift capacity, then rather don't have an army at all. Then, you know, what I would say is shut the thing down. You can maybe take some of these guys, turn them into some sort of paramilitary border force. Some can go off and work in private security firms. I'm sure some of them will, you know, pop up, you know, as mercenaries somewhere because, well, that's, you know, what demobilized soldiers do when there's nothing else. But don't treat your army like a sort of holding pen for people that, you know, can't do anything else. Very, very dangerous, very bad idea.
And if a military is performing its functions properly, if it is a capable, professional, equipped force that is, you know, able to project power to get things done, to develop individuals, then it will, as a function of doing its primary role, there will also be side benefits that it becomes a pathway for people at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder to maybe skill up or to build a career for themselves. Then it becomes also an institution that actually produces skills and discipline and these sort of things in the public. But first, it has to function on its basic role, and then that's just a plus, right? And you can see that, like, for example, in the US military where, veterans and people often from quite bad backgrounds. I mean, even the US Vice President, J.D. Vance, came from a difficult home situation. and eventually got into top schools and things because he went through the military there. But why did that work? Well, it's because the U.S. military is a very professional, well-organized, effective organization. I mean, obviously, it has its problems, as do all large organizations. But that should be the focus, and then you will get benefits from it. But, you know, if you try to do it the other way around, you're going to be good at neither, as you say. You're just going to be employing people to sit around.
No, absolutely. And something that South Africa, I think, can take a bow for, certainly in the early years after the transition, was the kind of peace-building efforts. But those were credible in part because South Africa did have, by continental standards, a fairly formidable army, at least for those sort of tasks. Now we've been, let's just say we didn't perform all that well in the DRC. So that, I think, you know, starts to work against your reputation. You know, you can, yes, South Africa can deploy a peacekeeping force, but who's going to take it seriously? You know, it's a bit like, I don't think the United States was shivering in its boots when the general promised Iran, you know, Iran, South Africa's undying affection and military support. So I just really don't think that they were stressed about that. It's and I think what these stories all have in common is that they all speak to the way in which the South African state has effectively become obsessed with or entangled in things that are not its core business. Well, you know, chasing visions and objectives that do not advance the general well-being, and just create more problems.
Well said. On a tangentially related point, Gwede Mantashe was speaking in Parliament today, and he was talking about Iran and the Strait of Hormuz. And during his budget vote speech in the National Assembly, he apparently said, quote, "We have undertaken to visit the Strait of Hormuz to see what is magic about this strait, this small passage of oil that destabilizes the world."
I would like to say that he was joking, but I can't quite bring myself to say it.
In light of all the things we've just talked about state capacity and things.
I'm gonna go see what's magic about it. Well, you know, I'll tell you what. I think that you know, he could go to a lot Harry Potter world in America. I think in Orlando there's another Harry Potter theme park. Probably be cheaper for the South African taxpayer.
Yeah. Anyway, with that, we'll call it to a close. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope that you found the show interesting, and we will be back tomorrow with The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone. Have a great one.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.